This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The Public Assets Institute has just released a new report that calls for major investments in a number of human service and education programs, and the plan also proposes additional funds for the state's transportation and water quality infrastructure. So why are these investments needed now, and how are they going to be paid for? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Jack Hoffman, who's the Senior Policy Analyst for Public Assets, and Stephanie Yu, who is a Policy Analyst who is very involved in the drafting of this report. Great to have you here on the program today. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about maybe expanding some benefits in a number of human services programs as a way to reduce poverty in Vermont? Does there need to be a major reform of Vermont's tax system? And is it important for the state at this time to make greater investments in its transportation and water quality infrastructure? And what happens if the state doesn't make those investments? Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. But better yet, just give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So, Jack, this report contains a lot of recommendations, raising the state minimum wage to a living wage, expanding the state's earned income tax credit program, public funding of health care, shifting education taxes from the property tax to the income tax, expanding high-quality early education programs, and as we mentioned, those greater investments to repair the state's transportation and water quality infrastructure. And we're going to talk about some of those very specifically. But put this report in context for us. Why are you making these series of recommendations right now?
For one thing, we think that given the change in the political leadership in that the state is going through this year, all the top leadership positions are changing. So we thought it was a good opportunity to, just take a pause and think about our state's priorities and start thinking about what kind of state we want, 5 or 10 or 20 years from now. And the recommendations that we have here basically fall into three categories. And one of them is this idea that we should ensure that work pays so that, people who have a full-time job can actually earn enough money to support their families. We also would like to see, smart, evidence-based investments. I think that the state is certainly moving in that direction. The legislature and various agencies are doing a lot more with performance-based budgeting. We think that could be incorporated a little more closely into our overall budgeting process. And finally, I think that we need to do some work in restoring confidence in state government. I think there's still more to be done with transparency. I think we need to restore planning that's been lost over the last 20 years. So those are that's sort of the framework for this recommendation and for the report. The other thing is we would like to change the budget debate in Montpelier and around the state. For the last it's almost 20 years now, the budget process is really looking at how much money is coming in and deciding, where we might allocate it. The legislature a couple years ago took an important step. They passed a new statute that is the purpose of the state budget. And it essentially says the purpose of the state budget is really to improve the well-being of the people of this state. And we think that's certainly a good principle to follow. And we'd like to see the budgeting process work on that basis. So we really should start out looking at the needs that we have in this state, the quality of life that people have, and look at the kinds of things that we can do to improve that.
I want to mention for our listeners that a link to the report, which is entitled A Framework for Progress, Investing in Vermont's People, Infrastructure, and Good Government, we do have a link at our website at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. So if you'd like to check it out in some detail, feel free to do that. So, Jack, are you when I hear you talk about this, it almost seems like you're asking a political system that tends to react to short-term crises and needs. You're asking this short-term system to reflect on the long-term. How do you do that?
Well, we do have a couple suggestions in here. You know, we could do longer-term budgeting. We do that on the revenue side now. We're starting to do projections out for 5 years. We think we could do that on the spending side. We do that in transportation right now. You know, the transportation department, the transportation fund, you know, they know what the needs for maintaining roads, building bridges, you know, they have a plan out several years. And there's no reason we can't do that with the state budget as well and set some longer term goals.
And Stephanie, does this also get to what the report feels is the proper and appropriate role of state government to ensure a quality of life for all Vermonters?
I think that's a big part of it. I think it's about sort of changing that conversation, as Jack was saying, from this idea of managing to the money to thinking really about what is the point of government, what is the purpose of government, and it's really to support its citizens and invest its money in things that, you know, benefit everyone, as opposed to sort of narrow slices or, you know, hit and miss. So I think that is what it's about. And it's also about thinking about government as a tool that citizens can use. I think there's, you know, there's a lot of national conversation going on around the role of government, around, you know, how helpful government can be. And I think we need to get back to thinking of it as a tool that citizens control, that, you know, they can direct to do what they need it to do.
You know, I'm wondering if we've got something going on right now that speaks to this issue. We have a revenue shortfall, or revenues are not coming in at the rate it was projected. So the Shumlin administration is going to all their department heads and saying, hey, we got to cut back here. Maybe not across the board cuts, but everybody has got to cut back a little bit. So is that a situation that shows exactly what maybe the report would say should not be happening?
Right. So all revenue systems are volatile. It's inevitable. We know that that's happening. We know that that's going to come. I was a budget officer in Michigan during 2005 to 2010. Michigan had been suffering from 20 years of budget deficits. And this was, you know, this was sort of a, it was happening every year. People would, you know, and these, we're talking about big budget shortfalls, you know, $1 billion. And so, you know, it's an inevitable part of revenue systems. But so the goal is, it's why we're talking about long-term planning. That's why we're talking about, you know, how you smooth that volatility and prepare long-term for that.
Yeah, one of our recommendations along those lines is to have build up, have reserve rainy day funds that are usable. We do have what are called the stabilization reserves now, which are, you know, roughly 5% of the general fund budget. But we went through this entire recession and really didn't use that money at all. And I do think we have to think about smoothing out the ups and downs that, as Stephanie said, are inevitable. You know, you go through cycles, revenue comes in, the economy is booming, and then the economy drops off. When this happened, and Bob, you and I were both covering it at the time, you know, in 1991, when we had a big budget deficit in that recession, you know, we did deficit spending. Governor Snelling did not slash the budget in because revenues had dropped. His feeling was that we really needed to maintain our commitment, especially to social services. And he recognized that during recessions, people need more help. And so, you know, we had a very large budget deficit. Today, I think we can deal with that problem if we had bigger reserves. I mean, one of our recommendations in here is to have a reserve of, say, 15% instead of 5%. So I think that would help us get through these the ups and downs and not have this yo-yo effect where we're cutting and then spending if the money comes in.
And there's also a great debate in the legislature with the rainy day funds. You know, is it raining? You know,
right.
Do we have to go to this? Is this a critical time to do it? Or are we inflating the size of the budget at a time when we shouldn't be?
Well, I think that we should be setting up the rainy day funds and having a plan to use them. And I think you can establish that. But I think we should recognize that the purpose, one of the purposes should be to smooth out the normal cycles instead of the way we treat it now is it's got to be a dire emergency. It's only if suddenly your revenues, you know, the bottom falls out, you don't have the money, and then you can dip into the reserves. I mean, I think it would make more sense if we could plan for these ups and downs. And have some funds available.
Today in the program, we're looking at a new report from the Public Assets Institute called A Framework for Progress, Investing in Vermont's People, Infrastructure, and Good Government. What are your thoughts about this idea? 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. What do you think about investing more in Vermont's transportation infrastructure, its water quality? These long-term goals, should politicians running for office today focus on these long-term goals? Would you like to hear from them and how they're going to address these issues? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. You know, we did get this email from Scott who wrote, "These are long-standing issues that will be incredibly tough to resolve, particularly in terms of funding for Lake Champlain cleanup, infrastructure upgrades to address drinking water, wastewater needs, and switching the revenue stream for transportation. There's not a lot of talk on the campaign trail about where to find the money for these major initiatives, yet these are among the major issues Vermont will face in both the near and long term." And Stephanie, I guess that's the challenge. How do you get people running for office to focus on these big, big long-term issues?
Well, it's tough, and I think that's part of why, you know, you asked about the timing of this report. That's definitely part of the motivation, is thinking about, as Jack said, this is the first time in 50 years that all the leadership positions are changing in Montpelier, so the top leadership positions. So I think, you know, I think there is more of a national conversation going on about these things. I also think that I think that people recognize that you can't put these things off forever, and you might have to kind of adjust to this idea that even, you know, the economy is growing, it may continue to grow more slowly than it did in the past. And so, you know, what is the reality of what you can expect from revenues, and what is the reality of what the needs are? So I think people are getting a little sick of postponing problems rather than dealing with them. And then the other piece, too, is you've got to think about what makes sense from a timing perspective. I mean, I think with particularly with infrastructure investments, they're going to cost a whole lot more if it becomes an emergency situation. They're going to cost a whole lot more down the road if we don't make the investments now. So, you know, I think it's also a matter of acknowledging, you know, the cost benefit of doing it now versus doing it later.
And Jack, I guess underlying a lot of this is, how is all this going to be paid for? I mean, you make a lot of recommendations in here. Some of them don't require money, but a lot of them do. This infrastructure stuff is millions, if not billions of dollars. What are your thoughts on how the state can afford to do all this?
Well, yeah, we don't have an estimate how much this is going to cost. You know, some of it is a matter of just establishing priorities, but you know, we're not pretending that this isn't going to cost money. And, you know, the infrastructure, you know, we recite a report in here. It's certainly going to cost a lot of money. I do think that we have the capacity. I mean, we've looked at, for example, how much Vermont has spent over time in relation to personal income in the state. And, you know, we hear a lot about how spending is getting out of control. But in fact, we're spending a little bit less as a percentage of personal income than we did before the recession. So I think there is the capacity in this state. You know, personal income in this state, you know, in round numbers is, you know, $30 billion. That's obviously not all taxable, but, you know, what state government spends in a year is, you know, $5 billion. So, and I don't want to get into the details of, you know, how much is coming from the federal government, but, you know, I do think that we have more capacity, and it's just a question of how we want to allocate these resources. You know, do we want to spend this money in a way that, you know, is going to improve the lives of the people of the state? And, you know, we think it can result in savings in the long run. I mean, a lot of the you know, we talk a lot about, you know, early childhood. And, you know, we've certainly heard a lot from educators about the importance of expanding early childhood. You know, I think that's going to pay dividends to our society in the long run if we make those kinds of investments now. But it is going to require us to spend some money now. But I think we're going to have more productive citizens and, you know, our kids are going to live better lives. So I think it's, you know, we really can't afford not to do some of these things.
And I would just add to that, too, that, you know, in thinking about the total state economy, thinking about total personal income, 10 years ago, we spent a larger share of total Vermont personal income than we are now. So there is, you know, there is some room there. But I also think what, you know, Jack's main point, which is this idea that these are the smart investments. These are the investments that make sense now and that yield savings down the road. We know what the effects are of poverty on kids. We know what that means for, you know, their future academic success and their future earning potential. We already know those things. And if we put that into practice, we started universal pre-K this year, and that's because we recognize that that's an important investment for the future of not just those individual kids, but the state as a whole.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Holly, who's calling from Randolph. Hi, Holly. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I serve as chair of the Capital Budget Committee for the town of Randolph, which is a committee set up by the select board and the town manager to budget out 5 years of planning, which is a rolling plan. In other words, we finish a year, we add a year on. And basically, we're responsible for figuring out what capital improvements to do throughout the town or maintenance to do throughout the town over a five-year period and come up with a level budget. And we get to within about 1 or 2% tax rate change over the years for the town government. So I'm not sure why this couldn't be extended, this law, which is a state law, could not be extended to the state legislature, requiring that state government do this as well as the town governments.
Right. And, you know, about a third of states do longer-term planning than Vermont. A quarter do 5 years out. About a third of states do longer-term planning. So I think you're right. I think it is doable. And there are a number of state programs that already have these numbers. It's just that it's not being done in a comprehensive way. So I think that is important to get to those, to get to that that better planning.
Today in the program, we're looking at a new report from the Public Assets Institute, A Framework for Progress. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, we're looking at a new report from the Public Assets Institute, A Framework for Progress, Investing in Vermont's People, Infrastructure, and Good Government. With us today, Stephanie Yu, who's a policy analyst, who was very instrumental in the drafting of this report, and also Jack Hoffman, who's the senior policy analyst for the Public Assets Institute. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Jack, just before we go on to the minimum wage and the earned income tax credit, I know there's some people who are listening who are going to say, you know, in the last 5 or 10 years, state government, the budget actually grew faster than the revenue base coming in. And they're going to go back to the family example of how does a family spend more than the income coming into that family. So what would you say to those folks?
Well, government isn't a family, and it's not a business. You know, the role of government is to step up when the economy declines. And, again, going back to Dick Snelling, you know, 25 years ago, I think you and I probably both remember being in his press conferences where, you know, he was talking about the counter-cyclical role of government. That when the economy declines, when people's incomes go down, when business is slow, that's exactly the time when the government has to step up and, you know, continue to provide services. And that, you know, the trick here is to sort of even things out. And then when the economy improves, that's when government can cut back. So, you know, I'm not surprised that and it really depends on what numbers you're looking at. But, you know, we've just been through a recession and the recovery has been very slow. So I think that we would expect to need more government spending in the last several years. And I think, you know, over the longer term, you know, the hope is that the economy is going to pick up again, and then we could, you know, we got good news from the census yesterday. I mean, income, median household income is up. The really good news was that the income for people at the lower end, you know, the bottom 20%, saw their incomes go up. You know, it was one of the best increases, you know, across the board. You know, poverty is down. So as the economy improves and things pick up, then I think we can expect to see government pull back. But, you know, I think the fact is that these things are going to move in different directions. So it's tough. But exactly when the revenues decline is when the need goes up.
And I would just add to that, if I could. I mean, I think this, when we think about school budgeting, we do it very differently. So when we think about school budgeting, each community votes on a school budget, and then they set the rate to bring in what they need to pay for that budget. And it's sort of the opposite. We act like the amount of revenue coming in is fixed and there's nothing we can do about it. And when it goes down in a well. Governor Snelling used to look at it and he used to say, hey, you know, this is what the rate needs to be because we need to bring in this much money to pay for all the things that we need to do. So it's sort of a – that's kind of been flipped on its head. And I think if we think about the way we do school budgeting, it makes more sense because we're setting up these are the needs of the budget and then setting the rate to meet it.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Scott in Colchester. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me. Just an example, you asked just a second ago. I may have gotten lost when I was calling in. But just a second ago, you asked the question, you know, using the example of the family, how does, you know, the state budget, you know, in reference to a family, how would a family budget? And the state should budget just like how a family budgets. In order to improve their wealth down the road, a family takes out a loan for a house and slowly pays that off, and it pays off in great dividends. It's the greatest generator of wealth, is making investments for the future. So sometimes you got to spend a little more to get the dividends in the future.
Scott, thanks very much for your phone call. Jack, is that a good analogy?
I hadn't thought of that analogy. It's, you know, usually when we talk about the you know, comparing the state government to families, it's, you know, how much money do you have, and, you know, you can only spend what's in front of you. But I completely agree with him that you know, we do have to think about making investments in the future.
So, Jack, there are some recommendations in the first part of the report that talk about raising the state minimum wage and also expanding the state's earned income tax credit program. The report saying both of these proposals are excellent ways to try to help people out of poverty. Why do they work so well?
Well, I think one of the main points here is that, you know, we've talked that Vermont raised the minimum wage a couple years ago. We do have a good earned income tax credit, certainly compared to other states. But our recommendation here is to think about using these in tandem. And I think where what we'd like to get to is this idea of providing a livable income for people. So through a combination of a higher minimum wage, maybe some adjustments to the earned income tax credit, you know, between those two things, people can actually, you know, people who are working can actually have enough money to support their families.
Could you just very briefly explain to us how the state's earned income tax credit program works and why you think it's a good vehicle?
Well, the good thing about the earned income tax credit, or one of the important features, is it's based on family size. So people can earn they get a refundable tax credit depending on how much they work, how much they earn, and the size of their family. So that's important, that, you know, we can't expect employers to, you know, pay people according to family size. So you need some mechanism to adjust for that. So the earned income tax credit addresses that part of it. But on the other side, we do think that the earned income tax credit, I mean, the minimum wage needs to go up. If the minimum wage is too low, then it's really all of the responsibility of taxpayers then to pay for the earned income tax credit. And it really, that to some extent, then that becomes a subsidy for businesses that, you know, low wage businesses. So the combination is that we're looking for is a higher minimum wage, but then supplementing that with adjustments to the earned income tax credit.
And I was just going to say, most states do have an earned income tax credit, but they typically are designed as a piggyback on the federal earned income tax credit. So it's a percentage share of that. Vermont is one of the higher, but, you know, what we're finding is that families still don't have a livable income. So, you know, our idea is that both the employer and the government have a role to play in ensuring that livable income.
Stephanie, I can just hear some small business people right now thinking, we'd love to increase the minimum wage. We would love to pay our employees more money. We can't afford to.
Well, and I understand that concern. But, you know, one of the things that we found when we were doing this is that the minimum wage is actually getting further from a livable wage, that even though Vermont is increasing its minimum wage, even though it's scheduled to go up, that the livable wage, as calculated by the Joint Fiscal Office, is actually getting further away from it. So we're not actually closing the gap. Even by increasing the minimum wage, we're not actually getting closer to people being able to meet their basic needs. So, you know, that's the fundamental issue. And I think we've got to look at how we're shouldering the cost of people not having a livable income now. You know, there's a burden on the safety net because of that. So, you know, people will argue that taxpayers are then subsidizing employers. So it's, you know, there's a lot of pieces to this question. It's not an easy process.
Today in the program, we are looking at a new report from the Public Assets Institute, a framework for progress, calling for greater investments in transportation infrastructure, water quality infrastructure. Would you like to see our state leaders, those people running for statewide office this fall, address these kinds of issues? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. And let's talk to Eric in Castleton. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind today?
Well, good afternoon. On my mind today is about the TMDL and the phosphorus and the Act 64. And it's my understanding that through Act 64 and the TMDL, we're going to be upgrading the water treatment plants. And the water treatment plants, only, you know, through them, we are attributing about 2% of the phosphorus load that's going into Lake Champlain. But as you can see, the cost of upgrading water treatment plants is quite high. So in essence, the rural residents of Vermont are subsidizing the larger cities in upgrading their water sewage treatment plants that we really don't have much benefit from getting in terms of phosphorus. Now, in terms of all the pharmaceuticals and stuff, yeah, we'd like to see that taken up. But how is it that the TMDL and Act 64 is the best vehicle to have that happen?
Eric, I'm wondering, maybe you know the answer to this question, isn't this sort of a central focus of the state's argument with the EPA about spending money on these sewage treatment plants?
I haven't spoken to the EPA on whether that's the best way. I'm asking whether, as Vermonters, we're going to be asked to foot the bill for the cities, you know, the rural residents are going to be footing the bill for what is going on in essence in the cities, because we're going to be upgrading their water sewage treatment plants.
Right. Jack, what do you think?
I don't know if I have an answer to this. I'm just not familiar. We don't address the details of funding for water treatment. I think, you know, we're just trying to point out that we do have this obligation. There is a big infrastructure need in the state, and I think people need to be aware of it.
We did get this from Nathan, who posted these comments on Facebook. As a middle-income person who's middle-aged, a single person with no children, I can read the writing on the wall. All these fabulous ideas must be paid for, and I'm sure I'll be footing the bill through increased taxes. I'd be more interested in a serious discussion about how we can stimulate our economy.
So I think one of the challenges that we found is that, and this is what we tried to show with our State of Working Vermont report last year, is that even as the economy grows, that prosperity is not being shared. So we can see that the economy is growing, but we also see that despite this great uptick that we got this week in median income, that median income is really going down. And so this idea that if the economy just grows faster, everybody will be fine is really not true. The majority of the growth goes to the top 1%. So it's not trickling down in the way that people hope.
And Jack, if we look at the transportation infrastructure, we have a system now, you know, based on gas taxes, diesel taxes. Folks are driving more fuel-efficient cars, electric cars. Revenue is going down or certainly not meeting projections. Does there need to be just a total change in the way the state collects revenue for transportation in order to help fund our bridges and highways?
Yeah, I think there does. And actually, we've looked into this, and I think there's actually a good opportunity here. But as we, you know, there are proposals for the carbon pollution tax, which, you know, I think we need to do in order to, you know, address the problems of climate change. And that's obviously going to create more problems for the transportation fund. I mean, you know, you're really discouraging people from using fossil fuels, so they're going to consume less fuel. So that's clearly going to undermine the transportation system. So I think a smart approach to this would be to try to solve both of these problems at the same time, you know, to figure out a new revenue source for the transportation fund, which probably is going to involve some sort of mileage tax. I mean, from the people we've talked to, that seems to be make the most sense. But if we could do both of these things at the same time, so you know, figure out how we're going to phase in a carbon pollution tax, and at the same time make the transition to a different revenue system for the transportation fund. On one hand, it looks like we're taking on, you know, two huge problems. It's going to make it harder. I think actually if we tackled both of those at the same time, in the long run, it may be easier.
There was a carbon tax proposal over at the State House, and most of the money would have gone back in lower taxes for middle-income folks, and some of the money, a small amount, would have gone to energy efficiency programs. And that was a tough sell over there, and a lot of people feeling, you know, Vermont cannot go it alone. There's either got to be a regional or a national carbon tax.
Yeah, I understand that, and I think that's you know, a good approach too. That makes sense to me. That, you know, if all the New England states were moving in the same direction, for example, I think that would certainly make it easier.
Stephanie, the report also looks at what it describes as the public funding of healthcare in Vermont. What do you have in mind?
Well, we supported the idea of a payroll tax. I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways to look at this, but I think the main point that we're making is that it's tough to get universal, affordable health care without some sort of robust public funding system. So this is really the best way. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, technical details in terms of how you get that done and how you shift, and even just during the transition process of shifting to a new way of funding it is complicated. But I think the bottom line is that, you know, is that we have, you know, it's great that we're covering more people. We put out some of the census data this week also showed that Vermont has the lowest rate of uninsured kids, for example. We've dropped our uninsured rate down to 3.8 from 7.2. So we're making progress on the universal front. It's the affordable front, and it's the reliable funding stream part that we have to lock down.
And certainly the governor looked at a payroll tax and decided it wasn't doable.
Well, I think that fight maybe never really got going. You know, I think that there's I think that there needs to be some groundwork laid. There needs to be some more consideration of what that needs to look like. And there needs, you know, stakeholders need to be able to weigh in on what works and what doesn't work. So, you know, it's not a quick process. To get to establish something like that is going to take years of conversation.
But the other part of that, of Vermont's plan, is cost control. And, you know, I think that the Green Mountain Care Board has made, you know, important strides in that direction. But healthcare is really eating into our budget. I mean, we've looked at some numbers, and you know, when you take out healthcare out of the general fund spending, what you see is that what we're spending for the rest of state government has actually come down in recent years. So we're a lot of our new spending actually ends up with healthcare, and then we're shortchanging the rest of state government. So it's critical that we get healthcare costs under control.
Well, this report certainly raises a lot of important issues for lawmakers to consider this winter and for people who are running for statewide office. Many thanks to our guests today, Jack Hoffman and Stephanie Yu of the Public Assets Institute. We really appreciate you coming by and discussing this report with us.
Thanks, Bob. Great to
Thank
see you,
you
again.
Coming up next, I'll talk with Secretary of State Jim Condos about the efforts his office is making to guard against cyber attacks against Vermont's election system. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There's been a lot of talk in recent weeks about possible efforts by foreign groups to hack into election databases around the country to undermine the results of the November election. Now, what are the odds that this could happen in Vermont? Secretary of State Jim Condos says it's highly unlikely because his office was the first state agency to undergo a thorough cybersecurity assessment. And with us now to discuss this issue is Secretary of State Jim Condos. Jim, great to have you back on Vermont Edition.
It's great to be here, Bob.
So the FBI is very concerned about this issue. How seriously do you take the threat of a cyber attack on Vermont's election system? Is this something that Vermonters should be concerned about?
Well, I think first let me just say that as Vermont's chief elections officer, election integrity is one of my highest priorities. And I want Vermont voters to know that we're taking every step and every precaution necessary. And we can go into some of that as we go. But I want them to know that we are taking this seriously. And I know that my colleagues across the country are taking this seriously. Now, we were involved in a phone call, a national conference call with Secretary Johnson of Homeland Security a few weeks ago when he first raised this issue. And one of the things we cautioned him about was to first learn how do they work? Because he thought that all of our election tabulators were all connected to the internet. He did not realize that none of our tabulators are connected to the internet, ours meaning Vermont's.
So what you're saying that every town that has one of these tabulators exists on its own?
It's a standalone unit that operates basically off of two memory chips. One operates the actual scanner itself. The other records the votes. So it's two different memory chips, standalone. Those are under lock and key at the town clerk's office. They receive them usually sometime within the last 4 weeks before the election, and they keep them under lock and key until election day. And on election day, they actually run what's called a logistic and accuracy test of those chips to make sure that they're running right. In other words, they actually perform test ballots, and they run them through the machine to they know what those test ballots, how they're supposed to be recorded so that they can see whether that machine is actually working. We have a very strong chain of custody issue with those chips. So those units themselves are standalone, as I said. There's no hardwire, no Wi-Fi that connects them to the internet. The other part of this that I think is important, and we wanted to make sure that Secretary Johnson knew this, there are 40 states roughly that you use a scanner, OptiScan equipment. And I think every one of those states, I know Vermont is the case in Vermont, is at the end of the day, we have an actual paper ballot. That's required by state law. In fact, I was on the committee and I made the motion back around 2003 or 2004 to require that there be a paper ballot after at the end of the day. So we have that. And one other piece that we do as well is there's a state law that requires the Secretary of State's office to do an audit of the election within 30 days of the election. I think you've been to some of those where we do the audit within 30 days. And we do – we've actually – we asked – it used to be a permissive the language said may conduct an audit. And when I took office, we went back to the legislature and said we wanted to change that to shall perform an audit within 30 days. And that audit originally was done – we would pick one or two races and run the scan vote tallies through. But now what we do is we run the entire election for that town, whatever towns that we are auditing. We run the entire election through, and we do it on a different system. So we and then we compare the results. And the audit has shown that the tabulators are extremely accurate.
So what do you think the FBI is most concerned about? Are they concerned about people hacking in and altering the election database? Are they concerned about people hacking in and changing election results? What's the biggest threat here?
Well, we don't know what the hackers are trying to do. The bad guys are trying to hack in. I don't know whether they were successful or not, but Arizona and Illinois have both been brought up as states that were attacked. I came back from that conference call, and we received, like, shortly after, within a day or two, we received the federal FBI alert that actually listed some IP addresses, and there was other information on it. And I actually gave that to my IT people. They checked our system, our logs, to see if those IPs had been trying to get into the system. We found none in our case. We also handed them to the state so that the state DII could look at the state logs and see if they could find any matches there.
So you mentioned Vermont is one of the states that requires a paper ballot. Do you think, given this concern over cybersecurity, that that's a good reason why paper ballots should remain part of Vermont election law going forward?
I do. For the foreseeable future, I don't think that we're going to see electronic. There's some states that are using electronic voting machines, where it's a touch screen, but there's no ballot at the end. There are also some versions of that now prints a ballot for you. Once you've used the touch screen, it will actually you hit submit and it prints your ballot, and you actually get to check it before you run it through a tabulator. So there's different versions of it, but like I said, there are roughly 40 states that use OptiScan tabulator type units that are standalone.
You know, we've discussed on this program in the past that some states are considering moving to internet voting. Do you think this threat of cybersecurity puts that on hold for a while?
I would hope so. I'm one of those that believes that we're not ready for it, although I know that a lot of the millennials believe that we can go forward with it. You know, they want to be able to vote on their cell phones. I don't think we're ready for that. We don't have the level of security yet that's necessary. And actually, the experts are telling us that we don't have that level of security yet as well. Now, we do use the internet, though, for one thing, and that is overseas and military votes. When we have their email address, we will actually email them a PDF of the ballot. They can print that ballot, fill it in, but then they have to mail it back to us. We do not accept email responses of ballots. You still have to mail it in.
So what will your office be doing going forward to monitor this whole situation?
As you stated in the beginning, I was the first, I believe the first state agency to do a complete agency-wide cyber risk assessment. And part of that came as a result of going to one of my national meetings and sitting down with Kate Brown, who was the Secretary of State in Oregon. She had just had a hack of her corporation's system, and we were talking about it. And I came back to Vermont, and I asked my IT folks about it. And they said, well, look, we're putting in new IT solutions. And almost every – I think just about every division of my operation has new technology. And, you know, the newer the technology, the more responsive it is to cyber risk, to cyber assessments. So what we've been doing, what we started – this was back around 2013. So clearly 3 years ago, we started the process of doing – we hired a vendor to come in and give us a risk assessment on our cyber systems to tell us where we might be vulnerable or not. It turned out that we were in pretty good shape. They made some suggestions of things where we could tighten it up even more. And then we also did penetration testing where they actually hire hackers to try to hack into our system and then tell us if they were successful or not or what they found as a result. And then we work with our vendors for our software to tighten it up if it's necessary.
So do you feel that you can assure Vermont voters that at this point the state's election system is pretty safe from cyber attack?
We believe it is, and we are in constant monitoring mode.
Secretary of State Jim Condos, many thanks for coming in and discussing this important issue.
You're quite welcome.
That's our show for today. Monday, we'll listen back to a program from earlier this year when author Stephen Long discussed his book on the devastating hurricane that hit New England in 1938. The storm had long-lasting effects on the environment and the psyche of the people who lived through it. That's Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and we had assistance from Mary Williams. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.